Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I'm Mona Kay, and I was married for 30 years, in that relationship for 32, and we didn't find out we were a neurodiverse couple until our 29th year of marriage. And I've been divorced since 2018, and together we have an amazing adult daughter who's thriving and doing fantastic. And my hope is that the information shared in this podcast will help you understand the strengths, differences, and challenges in your neurodiverse relationship as you move forward in life. Welcome to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. Welcome back to the Neurodiverse Love Podcast. I am really looking forward to the conversation I'm going to have today with my guest, Dr. Grace Maloney. And I found Dr. Grace in Janara Nirenberg's book, Divergent Mind. I was slow coming to read that book. And when I read it and I heard about all the amazing work Dr. Grace is doing, I asked her to join me on the podcast and she said yes. So Dr. Grace, I am so thrilled that you said yes and you're here today. Thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome. I'm so happy to be here.
Yeah, we're going to have a great conversation, and I know the work you're doing is phenomenal, and I'd love if you would share just a little bit about what made you decide to go working with neurodivergent individuals and neurodiverse couples.
Well, I actually started this a long time ago. It started with learning about my family and myself, my own child. Being a mom and just trying to figure things out, and then also being a therapist and wanting to help people like me.
That's awesome.
And yeah.
That's awesome. And so you have a group practice, so it's not just you alone in the practice, and you do assessments and therapy. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yes. Awesome. And we also do consultation. Fantastic. And we have social groups and we have Minecraft server.
Ooh, that's awesome. And you're based in California.
That's right.
Those folks that are interested in therapy and assessments, that's important to know. Now, do you do coaching too? I didn't ask you this.
No, we don't do coaching per se. We do consult. We call it consultation. So essentially okay. Help people kind of figure out their neurodivergent stuff.
Wonderful.
Parent support coaching, that kind of thing.
Fantastic. Because a lot of people contact me and they're looking for folks. And of course, you probably already know this, but California is the home of probably more neurodivergent folks than anywhere in the United States. Although I think it's growing in other areas as people become aware of their neurodiversity. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of things I want to talk to you about today, but I really want to start with kind of some issues that I haven't talked about a lot on the podcast. And one of the things that keeps coming up in the neurodiverse couple support groups that I facilitate is the idea of PDA. And I know there are two ways people describe that. There's the more pathological way, and then there's the more, I guess, neurodivergent friendly way. And so I'm going to use the more neurodivergent friendly way, which is a persistent demand for autonomy. And I don't know if you use another term. Do you? Is there another term you use?
No, I just say PDA.
Okay. Okay. So we'll do that. And because that's a challenge for a lot of couples and it causes conflict, I'd love to hear kind of how you help couples navigate that or individuals navigate that and what that looks like in your practice.
Okay. Well, for couples and individuals, I think it's kind of the same thing. With couples, it's more of I have to understand myself and my partner. So there's maybe a little extra layer there. But with PDA, I'm looking at kind of trauma and the trauma response and how we, I think, very intelligently take care of ourselves based upon what has happened to us, maybe when we were very, very young in a particular developmental window of time. Neurodivergent people tend to experience a trauma response in for different reasons than maybe a neurotypical person might. And so the way you store your memory or the way that experience is impacting you might be different from someone else. So let's say when you were very young, someone told you that, I don't know, you didn't smell good, for example. And so your trauma, your brain actually, let's say it was a particular developmental window. If someone had said that on one day, nothing would have been like, okay, whatever. And on a different day, though, at a certain time of development, what can happen is that the way you're thinking, the way your brain is thinking, it's like, okay, this is bad, this is wrong, and you develop a protective mechanism, and that protective mechanism includes a heightened awareness and a res I want to say almost responsibility to manage it. So we cannot have this happen again, kind of experience. And so you will avoid or not do something that could elicit such a response. And so that might be the start of, let's say, I can't do something or I won't do something because I could have that experience again. And I hope I'm making sense here.
Total. You are making so much sense. And I know just the few things you just said are going to be really resonating with the neurodivergent folks who listen to the podcast, and those who are in relationship with them are going to be like, oh, this makes sense. So it can very much be related to a trauma response or some trauma or negative experience the individual may have had in childhood, right? So they don't want to experience that again.
And I think those developmental windows can happen throughout the lifespan. We just have more of them in childhood. We're developing pretty heavily then. And I think that when we look at this response, when we're thinking about ourselves and our frustrations with ourselves, and we're thinking about our partner and what they're going through, it can really help us go to the underlying healing that's needed in order to feel better. Now, I'm not saying that you're still going to want to do this thing or that thing, but at least there'll be some healing, hopefully, when you go back and do that healing work, that trauma healing work to kind of discover yourself. I think people feel better. I've noticed that in my practice. So this is
That's
something
wonderful.
that this is how I treat people who come to me and say, I'm suffering from this experience. Now, if you're happy, then that's okay. I don't think we need to treat anything that isn't a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, how does somebody who wants to change in that area does not want to be so focused on demand avoidance or PDA? What are the like small steps that you help them get through to move forward and make some changes? What might be an example?
Well, you said small steps, Mona, and I think that's the biggest thing right there is to break things down into the tiniest steps, really noticing and appreciating when you even have any difference or change, because once you have a change behavior, once you change something for yourself, you're going to notice that and it'll become part of your experience. So that's the one thing is to break things down into really small steps and to notice that and to pay attention in your partner. But to answer your question about the treatment part is, well, it takes a lot of patience, I think, with yourself. But to go back and consider your life and your childhood and some of these times that might be, I want to say unspeakable, but this is to your own brain, so you're not speaking, but like things that are hidden in the closets of your mind. And so I think that's why therapy can really help, because then you're not going alone and you're having someone kind of be alongside with you. A partner can also do this in some ways, but I think it's a lot to ask a partner at times, depending on the situation and your relationship. But to go back there and kind of really explore, what happened and your response and how this response has built into what it is. At this current time. And I like going back and kind of using more of a parts look and going back and bringing your kind of more adult self into that childhood experience and kind of restoring that memory as past and how you would respond now. Like if someone said, you know, hey, you stink to me now, I would probably say, well, don't smell me then, you know, or something. But as a child, that was like extremely traumatizing.
Sure. And that the way you kind of put all that together makes so much sense to me. And in the relationships where I have experienced my partner engaging in PDA and not understanding and not knowing the right way to communicate, I've learned a lot. But the way you explained it, it makes so much sense. You know, when we're younger, we are oftentimes trying to please the people that we love and care about, and sometimes they hurt us with their words or physically or whatever, and that does get stored in our brain. So I love that. I think that's going to be helpful to a lot of folks. And you did mention the hygiene piece. And I know this is an area that oftentimes people are afraid or even they feel shame in bringing this up. Like, you know, my partner doesn't brush their teeth every day, or my partner doesn't shower on a regular basis, or they're not wearing deodorant. And that's not something that is easy to bring up. So if you have folks that are coming to you and that happens to be one of their issues, is there something that you help them like move forward and be more comfortable with, you know, their hygiene if they're in a relationship and that's important to their partner?
Absolutely. I think that hygiene is part of not only our self-care, but our self-kindness and our kindness to others. If that's our value, I mean, there's some areas and some times when hygiene is like you don't do it for whatever reason. So I'm speaking in the context of when, like you said, someone is wanting to have their hygiene different. You know, Mona, I gotta say that I think that hygiene is something that a lot of neurodivergent people struggle with, in all walks of life, all ages, whether, and it's maybe some aspect of hygiene, definitely sleep hygiene, teeth and oral care, teeth brushing, showering, bathing, that kind of thing. And it can go both ways. What I notice with neurodivergent people is that oftentimes we're very good at what we do. And we tend to do things in extreme. So we're going to do something either it's like I can't brush my teeth, and I usually see it as a sensory thing, a sensory sensitivity. A lot of the hygiene, you know, from let's say a shower, you know, it could be getting, you know, it might be getting your head wet or your face wet, but it could also just be the way the floor feels, shower floor feels on your feet. All the way through people showering many, many times in a day or brushing their teeth many, many times in a day. So it kind of, it's usually one of or the other, like an extreme. And so, but for the ones that are struggling with having the hygiene, I'll just say that what we work on is workarounds. And I call workarounds different than coping because I'm not trying to replace something. I'm trying to help find ways that, you know, kind of like in your brain, if you have a pathway and this is how you do things, and when your brain is learning and growing, you're going to develop this new pathway, and it might be around to the same thing because there was a problem with the one pathway. So you got to go right. You can't see my hands. My hands
Yeah.
going all over the place.
I talk with my hands too, Dr. Grace.
But so you're, you know, it's like you're essentially making a different way of doing, of accomplishing what you want to accomplish. So, for example, with teeth brushing, it might be brushing without toothpaste. It might be brushing without a toothbrush. It might be using a mouthwash. It might be only doing it on Tuesdays. You know, whatever it is the workaround that will work for you. We try to get that incorporated and in small steps. I think the thing with neurodivergent people is, again, it's the extremes. We go slowly or quickly. And I think really pacing well is a task that, you know, we have to figure out what's the good pacing.
Yeah, I so agree. And I think if you're the partner of a neurodivergent person who has hygiene issues because of sensitivities, being patient, because I remember one of the men I dated after my divorce, he didn't like it when I brushed my teeth. And I brushed my teeth several times a day. I don't know if it was the smell of the toothpaste or whatever. And he was just kind of uncovering his autistic identity. And he did not brush his teeth every day, but he used a mouthwash. And it was very different for me. And he said to me, you don't have to brush your teeth, multiple times a day, but I could not stop for him. That was not something I could do. And he did feel a little bit more comfortable brushing his teeth when he was around me, but it wasn't an issue because he did find a workaround. Like you said, the mouthwash worked for him. And so I think we have to be patient, with ourselves if we have the hygiene issues, and with our partner if they're trying to work on a workaround. And there might be several, right, workarounds that you have to go through.
Yeah, so
Yeah.
that's a lot of patience.
Yeah, it
You
is.
know,
It
so
is.
those are decisions every moment. Am I going to be patient today? Is this what I want? I'm choosing this. I'm choosing.
Yes. Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And so I'd like to talk a little bit about other sensory sensitivities, and specifically around sex. And one of the issues that you and I talked about when we were planning for this podcast is we were going to talk a little bit about kink and the LGBTQI community. And I'd love if you could address kind of some of the issues that come up around sensory sensitivities and sex, and what you've seen around the other two areas, the LGBTQI and kink communities.
Absolutely. I think that people don't talk about sensory sensitivities and sex enough because sex is kind of part of being an adult.
Yeah.
And people, who are neurodivergent tend to have all sorts of sensory intensity and sensitivity. And sometimes though they don't mess up, match up together, but everything else might match. Like you might, be deeply in love or whatever, and you're very attracted to someone, but one person needs lots of deep pressure and the other person needs very, very light touch. So my thought about sensory sensitivities is not only to kind of get to know yourself and your needs, but really have a lot of communication about that. And I know that everyone talks about communication, but sometimes this is hard. It's hard enough.
Yes.
First of all, you might be shy. You might have things are pretty intense for you already. And then you're supposed to tell someone, you're supposed to talk
Yeah.
about like those things when all you want to say is like, I don't know, something else.
Right.
So this conversation doesn't have to be in the middle of stuff. It's not like a little to the left, a little to the right kind of thing. This conversation can be done beforehand. I'm just saying,
Yeah.
sure, it
Yeah.
can be during the times too, but it also can be a conversation beforehand to really discuss and practice how what kind of touch feels good, what kind of anything feels good, and what doesn't, especially what doesn't. And I think that even couples who've been together for a long time, our partners who've been, in relationship for 10, 15 years, I've worked with couples who've been together a long time and they never discuss this.
Yeah.
And the hardship is that you might be worried if you talk about it that it will make a disagreement.
Yeah.
And that someone's going to be left without their needs being met. And it's probably you because you're the one that brought up the topic.
Right.
So that's where I think that, we're looking at healthy relationships where you can have good conversations. And so that's when I think you also need to, build that trust and talk about these things. And also you want to, because if you touch someone lightly, and they want to be touched firmly, but you want to be touched lightly. Your natural thing is to touch someone lightly because that's what you want. But
Yes.
if you want to be t so then the other person, you have this opposite, you're not getting that message across. And I think people kind of assume that the other person's going to understand where they're coming from if they, let's say they give deep pressure touches and squeezes, and because they want it. And they assume, well, this is, I'm letting you know this is what I want by doing it to you. And that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, and you don't want to reject your partner. And that's why I think what you're saying is so important to have these conversations ahead of time, before you're in the bedroom, and to say, what do you like? What turns you on? What brings a smile to your face that I'm doing right now or that you'd like me to do more of? That's something I talk about in the couple support groups. And, for some folks, it's really hard. And one of the things you said that I think will resonate with a lot of folks is those folks who've been married or have been in a relationship for a long time, they may not be having sex anymore. And their physical intimacy may be almost non-existent too. And when they learn that they're a neurodiverse couple, that's an opportunity to have that conversation because the sex may have stopped because of all the sensory sensitivities.
Absolutely. And when you have the sensory sensitivities, but you're not thinking about that's why you just think, I don't like this, or I don't feel like that. And so it's so important to kind of think, is it really that you don't like it, or is it you like something that's kind of that you don't think people talk about? And then you also had asked me about LGBTQ plus and kink. And I just wanted to say that in the neurodivergent, among neurodivergent populations, there tends to be a greater prevalence of LGBTQ plus and people in the kink communities. And I think that I just want to shout out to that or mention that because I think there is also a lot of people are marginalized or don't feel comfortable that they can talk about these things or talk about kink in therapy or whatever. And I just want to say that yes, we know this. This is like part of the our experiences. And also that I think that what I mean my personal perspective is that neurodivergent people have to go through so much self-exploration and they're learning about themselves and their identity. And so they're more, I think, finding out who they are. And maybe some communities aren't as, looking at themselves in this way. So I just want to, I guess that's all I would have to say about that,
Say,
unless you have specific questions.
well, no, I think this is great, and I think that the more we can explore openly about what our preferences are and who we like and what we like, I think the happier we'll be. And I think, I've had other folks who are either sex therapists or sex educators on the podcast, just a few, and we've talked about kink and a little bit. And one of the things that I hear repeatedly is that in the kink community and BDSM, there are more rules. And the communication is more explicit and it makes it easier, right? For somebody who is neurodivergent. Yeah. Any other thoughts on that?
I just think that what you said is that I agree. I agree. I think that the rules and the sense of knowing what to expect and having that sense of trust that's implicit in that type of sex is so valuable. I think that BSDM is, that's a part of, of that kink community. I think also there's a big poly presence in neurodivergent communities. So I think that that's just part can be part of neurodivergent experience. I mean, there's also ACE in the neurodivergent communities.
And I think, Dr. Grace, one of the things that I learned after my divorce, although, when my ex and I decided to separate, or before we decided to separate, I did ask if we could open up our marriage. And I've said this before on the podcast. I'm not sure what that would have looked like, but I knew that I wanted more emotional reciprocity than I was getting in my marriage. And so I always say to the couples in my support group and on the podcast, if you're in a neurodiverse relationship, your relationship may look very different from all your friends, from anybody else you know, and it's okay. Don't don't drive yourself nuts by comparing what you see other people doing to what you're doing in your relationship. Because as long as you're both consenting, that's the most important thing. And you're talking about what you each like and enjoy and don't like, right?
Yes, absolutely. I like how you said that. No.
Yeah. I've learned, you know, I wish I knew more of these things when I was married, but I didn't. But I've learned in each relationship after. And I know, you know, one of the things that a lot of couples who have recently discovered they're in a neurodiverse relationship are really challenged by, and that is masking and unmasking, right? And, you know, oftentimes I'll hear from the autistic partner, I am never going to go back to masking. I am never going to mask in my life and in my relationship. And then the other partner's like, I don't even know if I know this person anymore. You know, so I know one of the things that you mentioned to me was how important it was to know when you started masking or developed these masks. So, would you mind sharing a little bit about how you help either couples or individuals as they're going through maybe the unmasking process or they want to wear fewer masks in life?
I think that masking is like it's complicated. It's kind of like some relationships. It's complicated.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, because I think that we form masks as a neurodivergent people, person, people, as neurodivergent people. There, got my pronoun, adjectives or whatever correct. We form masks throughout our lifespan, and we form masks when we're learning how we can get along with others. So we might make a mask when we first go to school. We're in preschool and all the kids are supposed to, do this pretend play thing. So I'm going to go and I'm going to pretend play, and there we go, mask. And so forth. So those to me are natural neurodivergent maskings that are developmentally kind of what you can expect to see. And then there's the masking that I think happens, and this is where it gets complicated. Remember, we talked about kind of those windows of development and when a trauma occurs. And so I think that's when sometimes these big hard masks will come on and kind of become part of the masking toolbox. And those are the ones I think that can either be extremely helpful because, maybe you would die without it. You wouldn't be able to survive a situation or a recurring situation like, I don't know, going to school or living with your family. Those are very important situations for children, and we wouldn't be able to survive them maybe without certain masks. And yet, having those masks are what cause us a lot of pain. And so I think in a relationship, it's those trauma masks that most people are wanting to let go or to work through or to kind of not have to wear at home versus like some other masks that we might use, like to have a podcast or to, go to work and get on the bus or that kind of thing. Some of those masks, in my opinion, I think those are helpful, and we keep them like in a toolbox. It's kind of like, I'm going to wear this sweater. This sweater keeps me warm. This, I'm going to wear this mask because I'm going to go on the bus and I'm going to have to be around a lot of energy or commotion. And so, and then I'm going to have to walk this thing and then I'll get to work and I'll go in my little space. But, so whatever those, so I'm trying to describe different kinds of masking. And so, I'm trying to remember your question again. What was it?
Well, I know, I mean, I think you're doing a great job of kind of explaining why masks can be put on or why masks can be used. So then the next question is, and this is for the listeners, you know, do you know when you developed the masks? Because we all wear masks. And do you know when you started feeling overwhelmed by having to mask? Because I think that's kind of, for me, that's the pivotal thing for a lot of folks as I watch them unmasking or hear about their unmasking process. It's the energy it takes. It's how difficult it feels. It's how much I have to stay away from people, when I get home after masking for 8 hours or
Yes.
whatever.
But those
Right?
people were wearing multiple masks all the time.
Yeah.
And so I think that the masks that are going to be the heaviest, the ones that wear you out or the most, are the ones that you put on that hurt,
Yeah.
that take so much energy. And so some of those are just because you, I don't know, maybe socially you have to do stuff, talk to people, or it could be, you've got like 20 things to do that day and you have to try to remember what time to do it and keep it organized. So those kinds of things are going to take a couple of kinds of masking, and that's going to tire you out. The ones that I think that people want to, I would kind of think about that they might want to really consider how they can let go of or set down when they're in their relationship and they're in their personal time, are especially those masks that are formed with that were formed not because I'm wanting to be in this situation, therefore I'm going to create a workaround and see how I can mask up, but I'm forced to be in the situation and it's hurting me, so I have to do this to protect myself. And those are the masks. So those are different from trauma. They're slightly like, I don't know, a step different. I don't want to say down or up or anything like that, but they're less, you're not having like literal trauma responses from that situation, but it's like it's still so taxing or overwhelming. Like, okay, I can go to the school assembly, but it takes all my energy and then I go home and I'm going to be a mess.
Right.
And so that mask right there is too hard to maintain. And it's
Yeah.
too hard to maintain in a relationship. I'll wear it to go to a meeting. And so those are the masks that I think you really want to get to know, understand where did it come from, how is it, get to know your mask as if it's like another aspect of you. But it's, the mask is different from even like a part of you. And but get to know, because then you can have more power and choice over how you want to wear it, when you want to wear it, or if you want to wear it at all. And
Yeah.
how, and then choose, well, then how do I want to take care of this situation? Because I have to take the bus places because I don't have a, I, you know, I'm a hypothetical person might not have
Yeah.
a car, so
Right.
they have, or they use public transportation from choice. And so they need to wet mask a certain level. How do they want to do that? And that's the tough piece. I think that's the hardest piece, because by the time then you figure it out and you put it on, you're so tired.
Yeah, I so agree. And it goes along with spoon theory. And I've talked about that on the podcast a few times, but I bring it up in the couple support group, and some people have never heard of it. And I know. And so the fact of the matter is, just walking out the door, having breakfast, taking a shower, getting ready, all that stuff, you may have used up all your spoons. And then you have to put a mask on, or you have to mask to go to work and, engage in small talk or go to meetings or facilitate a meeting and all that. So by the time you get home to your partner or your family, you have nothing left. And, the mask just can't stay on. And yeah, so I think being aware of where and how you can kind of slow down and decide where and how you want to wear the masks, where it's most important, and where you can be your authentic self. I mean, I can't imagine having to mask all the time. I can't even imagine how exhausting
Ooh, and
that is.
what kind of stims are going to help you recuperate after what kind of masks? See, because I think a lot of people, they're like, oh, these are my five stims. I just do them all the time and I'm not thinking about what helps with what. But I think if you pay attention to yourself, you'll notice what helps make your brain feel more light and less like fuzz, and what helps your nervous system elsewhere, maybe your legs feel more at ease. And so when you come home from work, you might be need one kind of masking, but when you, I'm excuse me, bleh, I said mask, I meant stimming. You might need one kind of stimming or multiple stims, but when you go to work, you might need a different stim.
Oh,
So
that's so important.
what I,
That's so important. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
oh no, I'm just talking with you about
Yeah,
this.
that is so important. I don't think I've ever talked about that on the podcast, and it just a light bulb went off in my head. You know, I think sometimes we don't understand why our partner may need to put on their headphones and just listen to their favorite band for an hour after getting home from work. And you're like, where did you go? You know, why do you have your headphones on? I'm sitting right here. I'm standing right here. You know, listen to the music with me. No, that's part of what they need to do to decompress and unwind. You know, so, right, taking that
Yeah.
into consideration, I think we can have more compassion for our partners. And this is going to be, I think, very, very helpful to a lot of neurodiverse couples, this conversation. Very helpful. Was there something else you wanted to say around
Well, just
stimming or?
wanted to say that stimming or that, like you said, listen to their to me the same song probably over and over the same
Yeah.
kind of music when they come home from work. There's like come home from work music, and that is it's almost like pretend like I'm not home yet from work because you're not really all it's kind of like you're still collecting all those your cells because it's like when you're not when you haven't got your stim I'll just say, I don't know how I'll just say from my personal experience it feels like my cells of my body are not all together in the right way and that the stimming helps me and it's weird because you know it's like how does that help this but it does you know it helps me to get myself all together so that I can function I my brain can work so I can have a conversation with someone I love you know so that so it's almost like you have to say to your partner you know I it looks like I'm home at 6 p.m. but I'm really home at 7
Oh, wow. Go
Because
ahead.
that, because that's because otherwise there's that expectation, and then the partner who's home, you know, waiting, they're kind of feeling left out and sad. So
Right.
I think that there's, you know, I think we have to, that's another communication that I think sometimes we just don't think to talk about.
I totally agree. And, you know, we've talked a lot, or I've talked a lot on the podcast about different communication needs. And, you know, one of the things I haven't talked much about is value differences. And yeah, and you and I talked a little bit about that as we prepared for the podcast. And, you know, just like the sensory sensitivities and sex, I think values isn't necessarily something that couples talk about, even in the beginning of their relationship, you know? And so sometimes I think understanding each other's values can be so life-changing. Like, you know, even just what we talked about, you know, the value of having time to decompress. You know, maybe that isn't a value that we usually think of, but having valuing time alone, you know, is that something that you've ever talked about as a couple? So, do you notice that when you're working with couples that are neurodiverse couples, that they do have a lot of value differences, but they don't even know it or they haven't talked about it?
I think that what we do in couples work is we always look at values. That's like some of the first stuff that I think we need to do. And we're looking at all the values, big ones, like kind of like the, you know, overarching values as well as those, you know, the specifics. And we're looking at how do we're not looking at are they the same or do I agree? We're looking more is there what values are supportive of each other? So let's say a value is time alone, and someone else's value is quality time. And quality time, I'm more able to give you quality time, and I'll give it to you real good if I get this time alone. So that to me is of those values align. They support each other versus what values are in conflict. Like if, you know, someone does not, let's say they need always to have time, not alone. Time alone is hurtful versus time alone is needing. Then that's when we have to look at, is this something that can be compromised? Is there a give and take? any way to work, is there a workaround for this? Because values, I think values drive a person's everything. They drive your loyalty, they drive your trust, they drive your turn-ons, they drive sorts of things in a relationship. It's essential.
Yes, I totally agree. But I'm trying to think, in any of the relationships that I've had, if we ever really talked about values, and I can't remember doing that. And, I think sometimes we just assume, and that's a horrible word, assume, because we know what happens when we assume that our partner has similar values, and then we realize they don't. And so, and especially when, you've been, like, I was married for 30 years, and we didn't find out we were a neurodiverse couple until our 29th year of marriage. If you don't understand each other's values, even if they're, different, you don't understand why they're important to your partner, one or both of you might not be motivated to learn how you can support the other person's values, right?
Absolutely. I mean, Mona, I don't know if this is too personal, but like I would say, if you what you're telling me, it sounds like at least one of you is living in unhappiness for a lot of years.
Yes, I'm laughing now, but absolutely, we were. I think probably half of our marriage, one or both of us was pretty unhappy. And I think a lot of couples, go there. We were raising our daughter and we were focused on that and focused on our careers. But, when we got to the point where we were separated and really started talking about what we each valued, oh my gosh, we had some major, major differences that were not compatible. So I think talking about that's really important. And then talking about, the motivation each one of you has to understand your partner and understand yourself. If you're the neurodivergent partner and you're beginning to understand yourself and your values, and maybe you've been masking or people pleasing, for your entire life, you're not the same person as you begin to understand yourself. So that's where a therapist comes in, Dr. Grace.
Yes, especially when people kind of see that, okay, I fell in love with somebody's mask. And so, what does that mean for my relationship? What is underneath the mask? And how do I love this person that's underneath the mask? And do I? Can I?
Yeah,
Sometimes
that's
people can
major.
and they want to, and some people don't. It doesn't
Yes,
work.
that is so major. And I hear this again all the time in the couple support groups that when the person who has discovered that they are neurodivergent realizes that they want to be a different person moving forward, and their partner is like, that's not the person I fell in love with. I can't do this. It's a very, very difficult situation to be in when they still love each other. So again, if that resonates with anybody who's listening, there is an opportunity to have a therapist help you work through those differences. If you still love each other, I think there can be hope for you both to understand each other. And a lot of couples end up, not sleeping in the same bedroom anymore, or maybe living in separate locations, so they can have the things that they value the most without, pissing off their partner or, getting into fights. So again, as I said earlier, we can have a very, very different relationship than other people, and comparing can create a lot of angst and negative feelings. So we've talked about so many important issues, and I'm just wondering if there's anything else that you'd like to share with the audience that you feel might be helpful in your many, many, many years of experience working with neurodiverse couples and neurodivergent individuals. Is there anything else that you feel might be helpful to share or talk about?
Let me think. I
Okay.
mean, with the t thing that comes off the top of my mind, and maybe this isn't the most profound thing, but maybe it's like so known. But it's that every person deserves to value who they are and to love who they are. And I think that so many people give themselves a hard time and are so hard on themselves. And I think especially in the neurodivergent population, there's a section of people who are very perfectionistic and hard on themselves. And I guess I just want to say that it's okay to slow down and get to know who you are and appreciate yourself, because I think that the key is like, how do we even form our identity? How do we learn who we are and what is important, what matters to us? How do we matter to the world? What's our, how do we fit into this, I don't know, atmosphere or whatever, and like the universe. And I think that that is one of the biggest things, is kind of like those existential questions that I think that it's okay to look at them. It's okay to face them. It's okay to get support. And that when and you're in a relationship, I think it's really important to learn about yourself, and having that relationship really helps you to learn about yourself in relationship to someone else. That gives a good perspective. Was that too broad?
No, that was fantastic. And I want to add to that because I did not know I was ADHD during my marriage. And I could not understand why I kept leaving jobs after 2 or 3 years. I got bored. I got bored so easily. And so my resume is like 7 pages long, Dr. Grace. It's
I believe
crazy, right? So, and I was actually shamed for that, by some people. Why do you switch jobs? Why have you had so many jobs? And I was very honest. I get bored easy. But that didn't fly too well with some folks. And that's fine, but I did feel some shame. And now, being late identified ADHD, gosh, I understand myself. And I also understand how I screwed some things up in my marriage and how I could have been a different parent, but I can't go back in time. And I think that's what's so important for people to understand, that as long as you shame yourself and as long as you feel, you suffer because of the things you did in the past, I don't think you can be healthy emotionally. You have to work through that grief, and that you have to forgive yourself, and you have to have grace for yourself. And oftentimes it helps to have a therapist. I've been to several therapists who I thank God for, but there is a way to move forward and learn and heal and grow and become your best self.
Yeah.
But it may take time. It may take time.
Well, that's what, that healing that we were talking about earlier. I think it's so important that we have healing in our life, because I
Yeah.
think being neurodivergent in a world that hasn't until even recently recognized what neurodivergence is. When I started doing this 20 years ago, I called it neuroatypical, but I'm telling you, nobody knew what I was talking about,
Okay.
back then. So people are growing up in this world where this is very, very new. I think it's
Yeah.
very traumatizing to be in a world where nobody, and like ha most of the people that you come across, especially when you're a child, think that you're not okay,
Right.
or give you somehow those messages. I think there's a lot of healing, and that getting to know yourself and acceptance. What I'm hearing though about you, Mona, is that you've learned this about yourself, and I can see how you've kind of made this into something that you can celebrate.
Finally, I'm 60. I might as well, right? I
Yeah.
mean, seriously, it's just been in my 50s that I've learned, these things and accepted myself. And that's why I do neurodiverse love. That's why I started this. It was part of my healing journey. And now I know it's been part of other people's healing journeys. And the wonderful thing is that people are open when they come on the podcast. They're willing to share their lived experiences and their expertise and the lessons that they've learned. And it's helping thousands and thousands of people all over the world.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much for doing this. I feel
I
like
love it.
we touched on so many topics. We didn't go delve deep into them. So I just want to say that if people want to go deep into any of these topics, that they should. It's like
Yes.
if you want to, go for it, because
Yes.
these are things to think about, even like, I don't know, all of the things we talked
Yeah.
about.
We talked about so many important things. So now, Dr. Grace, I would love for you to let folks ha know how they can contact you. And do you have a waiting list? And how long is the waiting list if you do have one? So what is the best place for people to reach you? Is it a website, an email, phone number? Okay.
Yes,
What's your
definitely our website is therathrive.com. So that's like therapy and thriving. So therathrive.com. And then our phone number, we have it. I give you my 800 number, or is 888-777-2915. I was so thrilled when that number was available. It's like 888-777. It's so fun.
I love it. I love it.
Two
Okay.
nine one five. And then the best way, if you want to schedule an appointment, is to go to our website and you can click on schedule or appointment, and one of our therapists will re get back to you. We have It depends on where you are and what you're needing about our waiting list, because like waiting lists can be really long, or they can be, we can get someone in pretty quickly. If
Okay.
you want to see one of our associate therapists, who are awesome, we have a very, very special handpicked team where I, Katie, our clinical director, and I, we put people through the ringer before they can work for us, and we want to know them so well because
Awesome.
we have such a special group, a really awesome group. So nice team.
That's phenomenal. Yeah, because I also hear from folks who've gone to numerous therapists who knew nothing about neurodiversity and they've done more harm than good. So I love to know that you really screen all the folks that are in your practice. So again, you do assessments, you do consultation, you call it, or consulting and therapy.
Yes.
So
Yes.
yeah, and do you do telehealth? So
Absolutely. We do.
okay.
We're online. We have two offices, one in the San Francisco Bay Area in Lafayette, in the East Bay, and then one in the LA area in Toluca Lake, Burbank. So we're in California in two places, northern and southern. But
Awesome.
we also work online. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, it has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. And I know we touched on so many topics and subjects that are going to resonate with a lot of folks. So thank you for your time. Thank you for your commitment to this work and for sharing both some lived experience and your expertise. It has been a phenomenal conversation. I really appreciate it.
Likewise, Mona. Thank you too.